Okay, so first I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to this very nice conference. It's like nice location. I have to apologize, I was here all of last week, but I have to leave tomorrow because of some advisory council meeting in Stuttgart. So if you'd like to talk to me, please come and see me today. Okay, what I'd like to talk about today is some really simple systems that are insulating. They have a nearly cubic lattice structure, much simpler than the cuprates that we've all been interested in. And our first motivation when we started out, something like 2 years ago, working on these materials was to study metal insulated transitions and to compare them to the copper oxides. Okay, and the basic question is, in the copper oxides, we have superconductivity, high TC superconductivity. You know, there's a lot of other metal insulated transitions in transition metal oxides that do not show superconductivity. And so the question is, does orbital degeneracy have something to do with that? And our general approach is to first start with the simplest systems, sort of the lanthanum copper oxides of these early transition metal families that are insulating, and try to understand those before we progress to the doped systems and the metal insulated transitions. And it turned out that there were so many questions about the how to interpret the data on insulating systems that we haven't really been able to go into the metallic state yet. But I hope to convince you that it's almost time to do that now. Okay, because I think we've gotten quite far in understanding these insulators. Okay, I'd like to discuss these concepts in terms of two examples, titanium and vanadium oxides with one or two d electrons. Both have the simple cubic perovskite structure. And before I go on, let me acknowledge my collaborators in my group in Stuttgart. We have Clemens Ulrich, who did most of the experiments. Genial Khalyulin, who's a theorist, who we work together very closely. And all the samples came from Takura's group in Japan. And then there were various other people who were involved in either the experiment or the theoretical interpretation. Now, I know that at least a couple of people here in the audience have heard almost the same talk during the summer in Groningen. So, you know, if time permits, I'll throw in some extra results on systems that we've just started working on, iron oxide systems. Okay, just to introduce this whole subject, here's the basic crystal field level scheme of a transition metal oxide in a cage of six oxygen ions. I'm sure you've seen all that. Canonical example is lanthanum manganese oxide, where the manganese 3 plus ion has four d electrons, and the orbital levels are split into basically two different energy states. One is the lower lying T2g level, and that in this system is occupied by three electrons, and the higher lying EG orbitals are occupied by one electrons. Okay. Now, as you can see, there's a lot of orbital degeneracy in this ground state, and of course nature doesn't like degeneracy, so it's going to try to lift the degeneracy and the various mechanisms by which this can happen. And the most common one is the Jahn-Teller effect that you all know about. And that's actually the by far the dominant mechanism in these manganese oxides. Okay, so this happens at relatively high temperatures, so all the orbitals are occupied, and then the magnetic interactions between the transition metal ions determine on the occupancy of the orbitals on neighboring lattice sites. So, and that there's a whole scheme of rules that has been worked out in the 1950s and 60s that goes by the name Goodenough-Kanemori rules, in which the dependence of magnetic exchange interactions on orbital occupancies is written down. And here are just two examples. If you have two like orbitals occupied on the same site, on neighboring sites, then you have strong antiferromagnetic exchange. And if you have orthogonal orbitals occupied on neighboring sites, you have weak and ferromagnetic exchange. And all of this can be summarized in this so-called Kugel-Chomsky model that's written up there. Is there a laser pointer? Do you have a laser pointer somewhere?
Great.
Okay. Anyway, so it's on the in the first line here. All right. Low tech. Okay. Where the in addition to the spin variables, you define pseudo spin variables. And have the same commutation with relations at the spin variables, and depending on exactly what the values of these pseudo spin operators, the exchange interactions are determined. Okay, so but usually at low temperatures, these exchange parameters and all these these variables here are simply constant. So we don't really have to worry about these commutation relations at all. We just treat these as fitting parameters. Okay, so that's the canonical procedure in the manganites, and this is how it happens, for instance, in the insulating lanthanum manganese oxide. So here you have at 800 Kelvin, very high temperature, you get the cooperative Jahn-Teller effect, where there's a definite orbital occupancy established at every manganese site, okay, and they form this pattern, which you also call orbital order. And once you've got this pattern, then the exchange interactions are fixed, and then at much lower temperatures, magnetic order occurs according to these exchange interactions. And as you can see here, this is just one section of the lattice structure of lanthanum manganese oxide. Here on neighboring sites, you have orthogonal orbitals occupied, and according to the rules that I just told you about, you should expect ferromagnetic exchange interactions, and that's exactly what happens. Okay, so in this whole sheet, the lanthanum manganese oxide structure, you have ferromagnetic exchange interactions, and so you get ferromagnetic ordering in these planes at about 200 Kelvin. Okay, and since the interaction is antiferromagnetic when you go out of this plane, you get altogether yet the so-called A-type antiferromagnetic structure, which is antiferromagnetically coupled ferromagnetic sheets. And according to this anisotropic spin structure, you also see rather anisotropic magnetic dispersion relations in the magnetically ordered state. So these are the magnon dispersions, and you can see when you go off in various crystallographic directions, these dispersions look rather different, okay? And that's the generic thing to happen. So about 2 years ago, again, we started working on the titanium oxide systems. And at first sight, the crystal feed level seam looks very similar, except now you just have one d electron in this T2G manifold, okay? Now, you can see already that compared to lanthanum manganese oxide, the orbital degeneracy is larger. So instead of two orbitals to choose from, there are now three. And also, these orbitals, the negative lobes here of charge density, point in between the negative oxygen ions. So the lattice coupling is expected to be weaker. And a good sort of gauge of the lattice coupling, how strongly these orbitals are coupled to the surrounding lattice, is the distortion of the titanium oxide bonds within this cage, okay? And in lanthanum manganese oxide, for instance, this octahedron distorts due to this Jahn-Teller effect, and the distortion, so the difference between long and short bonds is about 0.25 angstroms. In the titanates, the most you can get is about five times less than in lanthanum manganese oxide. Okay, and the Jahn-Teller energy scales with the square of this lattice distortion, so therefore the Jahn-Teller effect is expected to be much less dominant than in the manganites. So one should keep an open mind and watch for other mechanisms to lift the orbital degeneracy, such as the super exchange interaction itself and the spin orbit coupling. Okay. So this is just to remind you of the data that we took about 2 years ago. Actually, I was here, I think, 2 years ago at the ITP when it was still called ITP instead of KITP. And I was talking about these data and some very half-baked idea of how to interpret them. So this is lanthanum titanium oxide. And so that's the system we started looking at. And what we saw is some simple antiferromagnetic order, G-type antiferromagnetic order with antiferromagnetic interactions in all three spatial directions. And the order parameter looks kind of normal. But there are two unusual aspects to these data. One is that this G-type antiferromagnetic order is not expected based on electronic structure calculations. So lots of people have done calculations on these systems, and it turns out that actually the ferromagnetic state is always the lowest energy state that's coming out of these calculations, unless you do something special and you tune parameters, etc. The other unusual aspect is that the ordered moment is quite small. It's only about half of what you expect from a spin 1/2 on a cubic lattice. Okay. Now this second aspect is maybe not so surprising taken by itself, because in these weakly distorted systems, you also expect a orbital component to the total magnetization that we actually detect in the neutron experiment. And in these early transition metal ions, you expect this orbital magnetization to point antiparallel to the spin magnetization, thereby reduce the total magnetization. Okay, so that aspect is in itself maybe not so surprising, but taken together with the inelastic neutron scattering data, it actually becomes a problem, because what the inelastic neutron scattering data show is that the spin dynamics is perfectly isotropic. So it's isotropic both in real space, meaning that the magnon dispersions fit almost perfectly to a simple isotropic nearest neighbor Heisenberg model. And it's also isotropic in spin space, meaning that this magnon gap is actually very small. It's less than a tenth of the overall magnon bandwidth. Okay, and that's something that you do not expect in terms of a simple system with an unquenched orbital moment, because the unquenched orbital moment always leads to large magnon gaps. Yeah. If you have an unquenched orbital magnetization, your spin dynamics generically becomes very anisotropic. Okay, so that was the starting point for theoretical investigations of this system. And since this lattice distortion is actually extremely small in lanthanum titanate, it's basically experimentally not detectable. It's less than 0.01 angstrom. Therefore, the theorists started out neglecting the Antiller effect in this system and looking at a pure super exchange Hamiltonian, augmented, of course, by spin orbit coupling in the end. Okay, but let's look at the super exchange Hamiltonian without the spin orbit coupling first. And so this is the version of the Kugel-Chomsky model that I sketched out in the very beginning, applied here to the lanthanum titanate situation. So what you have here is a spin 1/2 operator, and then you also have a pseudo spin 1/2 operator along every bond. And the reason is that only two of these orbitals, namely, in this case, the XZ and the YZ orbital, give you a non-zero exchange interaction along the C-axis, right? And there's a converse relation for the X and Y axes as well. So you're dealing with a real spin of 1/2 and a pseudo spin of 1/2, okay? So, and that led the theorists to a consideration based on some correlated spin orbital fluctuations. That was inspired by some work in one dimensions on similar spin orbital models in which you have an exact SU4 symmetry between the spin and orbital sectors. Okay, here, of course, in a real system, this symmetry cannot be exact, but the theory that Ginyard Khalyulin and Maekawa came up with is based on the assumption that you have similar correlated spin orbital fluctuations as you get in these SU4 symmetric models. So what I mean by that is that you sort of have a larger phase space than in a spin-only model, and you allow fluctuations in which a configuration consisting of a spin singlet and an orbital triplet goes into a configuration consisting of a spin triplet and orbital singlet. And it turns out that in the framework of their model, these correlated spin orbital fluctuations, zero point fluctuations, are strong enough to completely obliterate orbital order even in this insulating system. Okay, so that the result would be an orbital liquid. Okay, so that's of course a bold proposition. What sort of impresses me about this theory is that they can actually explain most aspects of the neutron scattering experiments with just one parameter, which is the super exchange parameter we extract from our magnon dispersions. So based on that, they come up with a prediction for the magnetically ordered moment for about 0.5 Bohr magnetons as observed. You also get naturally isotropic spin dynamics because these orbital fluctuations average out, so they smear out all the anisotropy. A similar thing is actually observed in metallic manganese oxides. There, in the metallic state, which is ferromagnetic in the manganites, you also see perfectly isotropic spin dynamics, and that's exactly because people believe the orbital fluctuations average out the anisotropy. And finally, you also can calculate the spin gap in the framework of the theory, and it just comes out to be 3 MeV as measured. Okay. Now, if the system here is really an orbital liquid, what you ought to expect is some continuum of orbital excitations in the ground state, and that should also lead to damping of the magnons, and we've looked hard for that, and we didn't observe that. So that makes me a little bit cautious about the theory, but there, you know, who knows how large this damping should be, and maybe there's a gap or pseudo gap in the spectrum. So that is certainly not reason to rule out this model. Okay, it would have been nice to see it, but if you don't, it doesn't mean that the model is wrong. But
what's spin gap referred to? Is it a magnetic ordered
state? This is a magnetically ordered state. Yeah, as I showed you two transparencies ago, you actually have long-range magnetic order. So you have magnons, and the magnons have a gap of 3 MeV.
That's the gap at the bottom of the magnon.
Yes. So I can go back. So that's this gap here. Okay, so this is just the magnon dispersion along one spatial direction. Okay, and the lowest energy of the magnon is the magnon gap. Okay. Now there have also been competing proposals from Imada and from Chomsky and others who cooked up some special combination of orbitals that also gives you isotropic spin dynamics, but they all required some crystallographic distortions. So they predicted a specific distortion pattern. We've looked hard for that, but we also didn't observe that. And of course, you know, these distortions could be small, so they may not be so readily observable. But at the moment, basically, the situation is unresolved. It's a nice proposal to have an orbital liquid in this insulating system, but we cannot really prove it conclusively. So that's why we decided to also study another system in the same family, yttrium titanate. Yttrium titanate has a smaller bond angle between titanium and oxygen, and therefore it has a narrow bandwidth and a weakened super exchange. And this system is actually a ferromagnet, and that's exactly what these band structure calculations all predict. Okay, so in that sense, it's actually more ordinary materials than lanthanum titanate, which shows this unusual G-type antiferromagnetic state. Okay, and these band structure calculations or Hartree-Fock calculations by Sawada and Terakura, I think that was an LDA plus U calculation, Mizukawa and Fujimori did some Hartree-Fock calculations. They all predicted this type of orbital ordering pattern in which a linear combination of these T2G orbitals is occupied on every site. Okay, and when you look at this orbital ordering pattern, you can see that the occupancy on nearest neighbor site is almost, you can at least imagine that these orbitals are almost orthogonal, and therefore you get ferromagnetic exchange interactions. And that's also what we see, of course, that was already previously known, that this system is ferromagnetic, so we see ferromagnetic Bragg reflections. We also see an admixture of G-type and A-type antiferromagnetic order parameters, and that's expected because these octahedra are canted, and that leads to Jaroszynski-Maria interactions that in turn lead to spin canting, and that in itself is not an unusual observation. What is unusual, however, is that, again, when you look at the magnon dispersions, these dispersions turn out to be perfectly isotropic. Okay, so this is the magnon, the full magnon spectrum now, and these solid lines are a prediction of a nearest neighbor isotropic Heisenberg model, and you can see that that goes all through all the data points. If you add a small anisotropy, you can improve the fits, but that isn't even necessary, really. Except here at the zone boundary, where the magnon dispersion runs into an optical phonon mode, there's some messy situation here, which we haven't entirely resolved, but the most likely origin of this messiness is some magnon-phonon coupling. But be that as it may, the overall magnon dispersions here are, to as good as we can determine, which is about 5% isotropic. And again, that means both spatial anisotropy and anisotropy at spin space, meaning that this magnon gap is actually very small. It's not even shown on this graph here, but we've now measured it to be about 0.15 millielectron volt. So it's much, much smaller than the zone boundary energy. Okay, so now we have two very different systems in which the spin dynamics are perfectly isotropic. You can, of course, cook up some special orbital state in each case in which the spin dynamics happens to be isotropic, and we've sort of gone through this exercise with Genia Kaliulin in detail. In this case, in yttrium titanate, taking this proposed orbitally ordered state at face value and just calculating the exchange parameters along the c-axis and the AB plane as a function of this parameter here describing this linear superposition. Okay, so there's one free parameter here, and then also you let this Hundsrule exchange coupling vary. I mean, it's experimentally determined to be around 0.15 here, but just for the hell of it, we've changed this around. And sure enough, we can find special combinations of parameters in which you get isotropic exchange interactions. But then if you just deviate ever so slightly from this special point, you get very large deviations from this isotropy. So you just go away 5% from this point at which the exchange interactions are isotropic, and you get even antiferromagnetic exchange interactions instead of ferromagnetic exchange interactions. So this spatial isotropy of the spin exchange coupling requires special coincidence. And it does so, these two very different materials, lanthanum titanate and yttrium titanate. So that makes it very unlikely that a coincidence could have happened in both of these independently. Okay, it becomes even worse if you calculate the magnon gap. And the reason is that in these, in the yttrium titanate structure, the octahedra here are elongated. So that leaves, in a simple crystal field model, leaves a doublet as the lowest energy state. And anytime you have a doublet here from the crystal field, the spin orbit coupling makes sure that you get complex crystal field wave functions and therefore unquenched orbital moment. And once you have an unquenched orbital moment, you always get large magnon gaps. And again, we've made this the qualitative consideration quantitative by just taking this crystal field Hamiltonian or this orbitally ordered state and calculating the magnon gap. Okay, and sure enough, you always get large magnon gaps. Okay, so you really need a fine tuning on several levels and in several different materials in order to reconcile our observation with the conventional orbital order that everybody knows and loves. Okay, so now in a paper that came out at the same time as our experimental paper, Ginyat Khalilulin and Satoshi Okamoto actually took the super exchange Hamiltonian and imposed ferromagnetism and just calculated, you know, treating this orbital pseudospins as real quantum variables, calculated the orbital ordering patterns in the ground state. Okay, and what they found is very different from this conventional orbitally ordered state. Okay, so these are some of their patterns that they found at particular low energies. And you can see, especially in this case here, that it's actually fairly isotropic. Right? So these don't look like regular d orbitals anymore. And because these orbitally ordered states have actually very weak orbital order. They do have some orbital order, but it's like a quantum Heisenberg model in which zero-point fluctuations are very strong, and they reduce the order parameter quite considerably. And due to these zero-point fluctuations, also the anisotropy of the magnon dispersions and the magnon gaps all much reduced. Okay, and that is actually in accord with our observations. Now, the question remains, of course, there were several other experiments that had claimed to be consistent with this previously proposed orbitally ordered state. In particular, there was a neutron form factor measurement by Akimitsu and co-workers, and there were also some NMR experiments. I can't say much about the NMR, and I don't understand enough about the interpretation of NMR experiment, but I looked at this neutron experiment very carefully, and it turns out that the interpretation was based on the assumption that you have a perfectly ferromagnetic state, while we actually know that we have a canted structure, and that changes the whole interpretation. So this neutron determination of orbital order, I think, is not leak tight. Okay. So, and the NMR pattern, I can't say very much about. So there's another question that remains, which is this lattice distortion pattern. That is actually not compatible with these orbitally ordered states. Okay, so if the model is correct, then there must be another origin of these lattice distortions. So we actually looked at some other systems that have S-state ions, so no orbital degeneracy at all in the ground state, aluminum or iron here, that are simple S-state ions, and sure enough, you find the same kind of lattice distortion patterns with the same magnitudes as an yttrium titanate. Okay, so that's the fact that the lattice distortion pattern doesn't match the theoretical proposed orbital ordered state, I think, is not a reason to rule that out. Okay, so of course we are still looking for some more solid evidence that this is really what's going on, and to really determine the orbital ground state. And one particularly nice experiment that was suggested by Ginyat Khalilulin was to look for the fluctuation pattern of the orbital magnetization, so-called orbiton dispersions. And they've actually calculated these orbiton dispersions based on their wave functions. And this is some of the results. So that turn out to be two nearly degenerate states. They have actually quite different orbiton dispersions. And so that's an experiment that we're going to do very shortly to try to look for these with neutrons. Okay, so that is the situation in the titanium oxides. I think we've argued quite convincingly, I hope, that orbital zero-point fluctuations are important in understanding the magno dispersions and the whole variety of experiments done on these systems. And now I'm going to move on to a different family of orbitally degenerate systems, namely the manadates. And there were actually some data a few years ago by Sawatsky's group that showed a very intriguing temperature behavior of the uniform magnetization. So when you take a crystal of yttrium vanadate, cool it down, magnetization first goes up, and then it goes down again, and then it goes up again. And there's some funny memory effects associated with this, the series of magnetization reversals. And Sawatsky and co-workers actually had a nice qualitative explanation of this temperature behavior of the magnetization. In accord with some previous calculations, they assumed that the XY orbital here is always fully occupied by one electron. Now, I failed to mention that in vanadium, 3 plus here has 2 d electrons. Okay, so that gets rid of 1 d electrons, and it leads to antiferromagnetic interactions always within the AB plane. Okay, so that is something that stays constant throughout this phase diagram. Okay, but then the XZ and YZ orbitals are just half occupied, and their ordering pattern changes as a function of temperature. Okay, so and as a result, you get this C-type orbital order, C-type antiferromagnetic order in this intermediate temperature regime, and then at low temperatures, you get G-type antiferromagnetic order. And this is the predicted orbital ordering pattern in both of these situations. Okay. So, and based on these orbitally ordered states, they could actually come up with a good qualitative understanding of these magnetization reversals. Now, this is just to show you what the orbital ordering pattern here looks like in the low temperature phase of yttrium vanadate that has G-type antiferromagnetic order. Okay, this was predicted by Sabata and Terakura in 1994 based on LDA plus U calculations. And so this is what we found with elastic neutron scattering. So monitoring various Bragg peaks here as a function of temperature. And indeed, we found the magnetic ordering patterns that were hypothesized by Sawatsky and co-workers. They were actually known before already from Yoshizawa and others. So we basically confirmed the overall picture, which consists of a G-type antiferromagnetic state at low temperatures and a C-type state at larger temperatures. Okay, but when you look in more detail, it turns out that in this intermediate temperature phase, the spin structure is much more complicated than this, and I'll talk about that a little more. Okay, but first let's look again at this low temperature phase. Here you have magnon dispersion spectrum that looks at least qualitatively consistent with this state predicted by Sabata and Terakura. The only thing is that you again find almost perfectly isotropic spin dynamics, at least spatially isotropic spin dynamics, but the spin wave gaps are now quite a bit larger than in the titanates. So overall, except for this oddity that, again, you have the same exchange constants in both directions, we believe that the picture is not inconsistent with this orbitally ordered state. Now, in this intermediate temperature phase, even the elastic neutron scattering pattern is actually quite odd. There are various peculiar features. In particular, the overall ordered moment here is only one Bohr magneton. That's about half of what you expect for 2D electrons, for a spin one system, okay? And at the same temperature, in the G-type phase, the ordered moment is 1.7 Bohr magnetons. So, you know, 70% of your total magnetization somehow goes away at this orbital reordering transition. Okay? And the other odd feature here is this canting, and the spin canting here, which is of G-type, is actually very pronounced. So the canting angle is about 16 degrees, and that's much larger than what you expect on the basis of ordinary super exchange anisotropies. I showed you an yttrium titanate, for instance, the canting angle was like, more like 5%, 5 degrees. Okay, so this is much larger than that. So there must be some reason for that. And things become even more intriguing when you look at the magnon dispersions. Okay, these are the magnon dispersions in the high temperature phase. And consistent with the Bragg diffraction pattern, you see low energy magnons both at the C-type ordering wave vector, right? So that's half, half, zero, and at the G-type ordering wave vector, half, half, half. Okay, so that's consistent with the observation from elastic neutron scattering. Now, the simplest explanation of the coexistence of these two types of Bragg peaks is, of course, that there's some phase coexistence. This is, after all, a first-order transition, so you might expect some hysteresis and some two-phase coexistence over some temperature range. But the fact that you see the same spin gap here at both ordering wave vectors, whereas in the low temperature phase, at the same temperature, this magnon gap is much larger, rules out that scenario. So that must mean that this is a coherent ordering pattern that involves both of these ordering wave vectors. Okay, so that the simplest explanation is ruled out. The other odd features of this magnon spectrum is that the overall bandwidth here is about a factor of 2 smaller than the low temperature phase. Okay, so suddenly the whole magnon spectrum collapses. Third odd feature is that in the C-axis direction, okay, the bandwidth is actually larger than in the AP plane. And that's inconsistent with the simple good enough Kanamori rules that I told you about in the very beginning, according to which ferromagnetic exchange is generically weaker than antiferromagnetic exchange. Okay. But finally, the most unusual feature is that this magnon spectrum actually consists of 2 branches, an optical branch and an acoustic branch. And that is not a simple consequence, as we now know, of the canting patterns, but it requires some kind of larger magnetic unit cell. Okay, and actually, you can fit this spectrum extremely well by the assumption that you actually have 2 different exchange parameters along the C-axis direction. Okay, and these exchange parameters differ by about a factor of 2. So that would mean that the exchange path along the C-axis direction is dimerized. Okay, so that's the phenomenology. And now, just to convince you that we're doing things right, that we haven't made a stupid mistake, I'm showing this magnon spectrum of lanthanum vanadate that's also a C-type antiferromagnet, same spin structure as in this intermediate temperature phase of yttrium vanadate, but here you see all the usual features associated with orbital order in these systems. You have a larger bandwidth in the AB plane than in the C-axis direction. You have a spectrum that is not split into optical acoustic branches. You have large magnon gaps, as expected, based on some unquenched orbital magnetization, etc. So this is sort of the prototype of what one might expect to see in these systems without orbital fluctuations. Okay. So now let's look at the super exchange Hamiltonian for yttrium vanadate. Okay. Now again, we're dealing here with a spin 1 system because the Hund's rule exchange coupling is quite large. We're also following the prediction by electronic structure calculations that this XY orbital is always fully occupied, and that this is actually responsible for the antiferromagnetic interaction within the plane. Okay, so that leaves us with the super exchange Hamiltonian along the C-axis. So again, we have a super orbital pseudospin operator of 1/2 operating here in this XZ, YZ orbital subspace. And this total Hamiltonian here was actually derived by Khalulin and others in last year. And looks actually rather complicated, even though it doesn't even contain this intra-atomic spin orbit coupling, okay, which we'll talk about a little later. So that looks somewhat messy, but you can actually understand the ground states of this one effective one-dimensional spin orbital model quite qualitatively by looking at a single bond along the c-axis direction, okay, and neglecting for now the intra-atomic Hund-Sruhl interaction. So this is sort of the bare-bone super-exchange Hamiltonian, and of course you then need to switch on later this the Hund-Sruhl coupling in order to get a full understanding of the different ground states of this Hamiltonian. But if you look at a single bond, it's very easy to convince yourself that the ground state is actually an orbital dimer. Okay, so you have an orbital singlet configuration on this bond. Okay, and that gives you the lowest. That basically gives you a negative sign here for this factor, and then you get a positive sign here that gives you low energy. And it turns out to be the lowest energy for a single bond. Okay, so that for a single bond you get a ground state energy of minus 1/4 of the super exchange coupling. Okay, so that's, and that actually is this simple consideration for a single bond that also applies to the full super exchange Hamiltonian in the limiting case in which this Hund-Sruhl coupling is zero. But of course, if you switch on the Hund-Sruhl coupling, you always favor ferromagnetism. So you expect that there is a phase transition here as a function of the Hund-Sruhl coupling between these two different states, a simple ferromagnet and this orbital dimer state, which is actually quite similar to the pile state that we all know about from one-dimensional metals. Okay, so in order to test this in more detail and more quantitative detail, Halyulin and Jesko Sirka from the University of Dortmund actually carried out some transfer matrix renormalization group results. I can't tell you much about the technique. You probably know much more about that than myself. But the technique, as far as I understand, is very good in predicting the finite temperature properties of one-dimensional systems, including correlationing. Okay, that's why it was done here in this case. So, and this is here some predictions for the spin correlator, nearest neighbor spin correlator, as a function of temperature and units of the super exchange coupling energy for various values of the Hund-Sruhl exchange interaction. Okay, and that's the same for the pseudo spin nearest neighbor correlator. Okay, and as you can see, there is actually phase transition. At least when you extrapolate these curves here to zero temperature, you can see that at large values of eta, which is the Hund-Sruhl exchange divided by the super exchange, you actually get ferromagnetism at zero temperatures, and then you progressively go through a phase transition in which this spin correlator becomes negative, and then you look at the orbital pseudo-spin correlator, you actually get a value of minus 3/8 per bond, which is exactly what you expect from this orbital pirate state. So you can identify this quantum phase transition at zero temperature in this model as a transition from this orbital pirate state to a ferromagnetic state. Okay, and the transition happens to be around 0.11, which is very close to the experimental value of 0.15. So that means that in this system, these two states are nearly degenerate. Okay. Now, these two theorists also calculated the correlation length here as a function of temperature for various states, including this spin and orbital dimer state. That's the orbital pirate state that I just discussed. Okay, and as a function of temperature, this correlation length, this is kind of confusing to look at because the correlation length is multiplied by T. So it looks as if this correlation length is actually growing sort of as a function of temperature, but that's of course not the case. But the point of this picture here is to compare the correlation lengths of these various quantum states, and it turns out that at intermediate temperatures, actually in the temperature range in which this unusual C-type phases observed in intravanadate, this orbital pilot state is actually the lowest energy state. And the reason is basically that due to these weak exchange bonds here, so within the orbital dimer, the exchange coupling is strong and ferromagnetic, but the exchange coupling is weak and antiferromagnetic between the orbital dimers. And because of this weak exchange coupling, the entropy in this orbital pilot state is very large. And therefore, you get an entropy. So entropy enhances the correlation length here compared to other possible ground states of this model. Okay. So that's, we believe, a quantitative explanation of this unusual intermediate temperature phase of the intravanadate in terms of an effective one-dimensional spin orbital model. And the final question that I want to answer is the role of the spin orbit coupling, which is not small. So it's about, you know, in this 15 to 20 MeV range. Okay, so it's comparable actually to the magnon bandwidth that you see in the intermediate temperature phase. So you cannot simply neglect it. So if you take that into account, then of course it wants to anti-align the spin and orbital moment at every site, and that is incompatible with the super exchange interaction as we discussed. So that this super exchange coupling prefers orbital antiferromagnetism along C. And the best compromise between these two interactions is sort of a spin flop of the spin moment in the XY plane. So, if the spin moment is in the XY plane, it can actually take advantage to some degree of the spin orbit coupling by canting. And that's exactly the canting that we observe experimentally, and that can be quite large because the super spin orbit coupling is actually quite large. While at the same time, being ferromagnetically coupled along the C-axis direction. Okay, so that leads to a G-type canting pattern as observed, and you can also simulate this in this TMRG model. And it turns out that the spin anisotropy is actually XY type easy plane like in this intermediate temperature regime, which corresponds quantitatively to the temperature regime in which this unusual phase is observed. And even though it's not shown here, if you look at sort of this mixed correlator spin and orbital pseudo spin, you actually get a canting angle of the order of 10 degrees in this model. Okay, so just to conclude, I'm not sure. Yeah. Okay, I think I've convinced you that the neutron scattering, inelastic neutron scattering, is very sensitive to the orbital state. So it's very hard to just fiddle with some parameters and fit these magnon spectra convincingly if you don't have the right model. And I think I've also convinced you that this standard lattice-driven orbital order picture is not adequate for these systems. T2G systems may be good enough for the manganites, but not for these T2G systems. Models that treat this orbital pseudospin as a quantum variable instead of sort of an icing-type variable without its own quantum dynamics actually describe these magnon data and the corresponding elastic neutron scattering data very well, and they provide a quantitative understanding also of these magnetization reversals. That aspect I haven't talked about because that's quite messy. It involves various cantings of spins and octahedra, etc. But at the end of the day, if you take all that into account, it can actually provide a good understanding of these magnetization reversals that were observed earlier by George and collaborators. In terms of super exchange parameters that are itself temperature dependent, okay, because the orbital state changes as a function of temperature, the entire super exchange Hamiltonian also changes as a function of temperature. Finally, I think the neat aspect of these data on itravanidate is that there may be actually a realization of at least some spin orbital model in a three-dimensional magnetic insulator. And the ground state here is actually this orbital pirate state, and that's consistent with many of our experimental data. There are some future issues that we're about to address. One is the experimental detector of orbital order in yttrium titanate. That's an open issue. We believe that orbital order is there, but we don't know at which temperature it sets in. Nobody has good evidence, leak-tight evidence, that there is orbital order at all, and we know even less at what temperature it is established. And one way to find out is by measuring these orbitron dispersions by neutron scattering. And finally, of course, we also want to address the role of charge carriers in these systems. Okay, so if I have a couple of more minutes, then I'll just show some of these data on iron oxide. This is just some preliminary data that we've acquired during the last few weeks on this system. Strontium iron oxide, again, another pseudo-cubic perovskite. What's interesting about this system is that even this stoichiometric system here is actually metallic. Okay, so iron is in the formal valence state 4 plus here, 3d4. So it's metallic, and that's unusual, because most of these stoichiometric pseudo-cubic transition metal oxides are actually mod insulators. But this is a metallic system, and it has this unusual helix structure at 130 Kelvin. Okay, and we are interested in doing inelastic neutron scattering on these systems, so we managed to grow some large single crystals, which is something that actually took some effort, hasn't been accomplished before. And we also observed this helix state. That's not really unusual, but that in order to get this stoichiometry, you actually have to anneal the crystals under high oxygen pressure. If you just take as grown strontium iron oxide crystals, they are oxygen deficient. On these crystals, you see a different set of magnetic Bragg reflections that are actually commensurate. So the incommensurability, the wave vector here along the 111 direction is about 0.2. And that's the wave vector as a function, ordering wave vector as a function of temperature. Okay. And then we were wondering, what this new type of magnetically ordered state in this strontium iron oxide system might be. And we did some optical conductivity measurements, and it turned out that actually below this ordering temperature of about 78 Kelvin, the system becomes insulating. And there are lots of new phonon modes in this optical conductivity spectrum. And that indicates that there is some kind of charge ordering going on. So this looks like a combined spin charge density wave. And that actually was observed before, both by electron diffraction here on small single crystals or thin films of lanthanum doped strontium iron oxide. And here you see, this is a paper by Takura's group. They saw similarly charged ordered state here with the ordering wave vector along the 111 direction. And Fujimori and collaborators actually came up with a model for the magnetic structure that I find quite interesting, because it involves oxygen moments here. Okay, so this is a picture of successive planes, lattice planes, along the 111 direction, which involve, and here you see the iron moments. And if there's an oxygen moment sitting between two iron moments, the exchange coupling is ferromagnetic. And if oxygen is divalent here, the exchange coupling is antiferromagnetic. And this kind of charge order provides a very good description also for this newly discovered commensurate magnetically ordered state that we observed in in the as-grown strontium iron oxide, oxygen-deficient strontium iron oxide. So this is just the very beginning of an investigation of this system, which also, of course, involves orbital degeneracy and these various charge and spin-ordered states. And we have large enough single crystals that we can also do inelastic spectroscopy, both optical and neutron spectroscopy. Okay, so that's just a preview of coming work, essentially. So thank you for your attention. Actually, the answer is I don't know. I think it is, but I'm not sure about that. I'm not even sure if anybody's really investigated that in detail. So there may be some experts in this room who can answer this question much better than I can. But there's some work by Zhang at Cincinnati. He did quite a lot of work, I think also involving numerics on these one-dimensional SU4 models. So you might want to look in that direction.
Typically, if you arrive at the Kulgonskian Hamiltonian, you don't have SU2 symmetry for the orbital sector. As I understood it, in your model, there is SU2 symmetry for the orbital. So is it something to worry about, or is it in the Z direction that these anisotropies are small?
Well, just to make things clear, I mean, I'm not arguing that this model here is, I'm just using this SU4 symmetry, to motivate, to intuitively explain some of these results. So, of course, the real models are not actually SU4 symmetric. I think just want to make that clear. Well, I mean, what we're simulating here is, of course, the real model, right? It's not a toy model that has SU4 symmetry, right? So, if in this model calculation, of course, you can criticize. Well, one valid criticism might be that actually we have interchain interactions also. How come you can describe everything with a one-dimensional spin orbital model? But actually, these interchain interactions were taken into account in some of these calculations in a mean field description, and they didn't qualitatively answer the results. So, qualitatively change the results. So there's some criticism that you can make, but you can't say, okay, we assume there is a force symmetry, because we didn't.
Yeah.
The third position that you have in mind for London, the idea of rate, that is orbitally we have a gap in the orbital sector, or we have gap as
a Okay, so originally the picture that Khalilulin and Maekawa developed was for an orbital liquid with a gapless spectrum. And based on that, they predicted actually some low temperature specific heat contribution that's linear in temperature, so it's a gamma term. And that was, Takura went back and redid his specific heat measurements. He didn't see any appreciable gamma term of this type. So and then the answer, well, that means that there's some kind of gap, at least a pseudo gap in this orbital spectrum. And it's not impossible to rationalize that on the basis of this model. I mean, these models are very hard to deal with, and nobody can really reliably calculate gaps or pseudo gaps in this model. I mean, we've had difficulties with a two-dimensional TJ model. These models are three-dimensional, so they're even more difficult. So you cannot make reliable statements about the presence or absence of pseudo gaps in the spectrum. So that in itself does not rule out that this system is actually an orbital liquid with a reasonably large gap that kills this gamma term specific heat. So experimentally we know that there has to be a gap in the spectrum.
So in this specific heat, does one make a subtraction from this constant Ti of 3 to get rid of the lattice contribution?
No. You just cool this thing down to low temperatures, and then anything that deviates from the cube, well, that's linear in temperature, that's a gamma term in the specific heat. The phonons give you a cubic contribution. Magnons are frozen out at low temperatures because we have a gap of 3 MeV. So anything that survives to very low temperatures has to come from these orbital excitations. But within the experimental sensitivity, they didn't see this linear specific heat contribution.
George, last question.
I see the observation term. I don't think it disappeared when you create more
planes. No. That's all still present. So you have to, of course, in order to get a picture of a real quantitative understanding of these magnetization reversals, you have to take these anisotropies into account. And the picture is not qualitatively different from the one that you developed, except that all these exchange couplings are now temperature dependent. So they're not fixed parameters, but...
we had them temperature dependent. They were different in the different phases, actually, because of the difference in the work all ordering.
Yeah, they were different in the different phases.
Right.
But even within this intermediate temperature phase, you actually have the super exchange, the Jaroszynski-Maria coupling, temperature dependent, right? Because the orbital order, develops as a function of temperature. But qualitatively, it's still the same as you as in your analysis. Yeah.
Okay, so it's a beautiful example, like such an old system which we all mentioned in the book of Goodenough 30 years ago, produced such an interesting physics.
Okay,
so thanks a lot.
Thank you.